The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And on the cover of the week, this week, is a picture of Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law. He is in royal garb with a cape and a throne on his head. In his hand, he's holding a globe and he's smiling. And the title says, America's Princeling, How Trump's Son-in-Law Jared Kushner Inherited the Earth. And we'll go into the main stories and how they were covered. Trump team's allegations against Susan Rice. What happened? Republicans this week accused former Obama administration National Security Advisor Susan Rice of using intelligence information to spy on President Donald Trump's associates, a claim Democrats insist is designed to distract attention from the investigation into the Trump campaign's links to Russia. Rice reportedly asked intelligence agencies in her final weeks in office to provide her with the names of some Trump associates who had been mentioned in surveillance reports about foreign nationals. The identities of U.S. citizens caught up in incidental collection are typically concealed in internal intelligence reports, but high-level officials can ask for them to be unmasked. In an interview on NBC, Rice said unmasking was sometimes necessary to do my job and insisted that she had never leaked names or used intelligence for political purposes. The Rice revelation came amid a fierce partisan struggle over the FBI and congressional investigations into whether Trump loyalists colluded in Russia's meddling in the 2016 campaign. The investigation by the House Intelligence Committee essentially ground to a halt in rancor after its Republican chairman, Devin Nunes of California, privately met with two White House officials and then announced he'd seen reports showing Trump aides were incidentally swept up in surveillance. In other developments, Russian spies targeted former Trump campaign advisor Carter Page after meeting with him in 2013, BuzzFeed.com reported. Trump campaign donor and advisor Eric Prince, a founder of the security firm Blackwater, had a secret overseas meeting in January with a Russian close to President Vladimir Putin in an attempt to establish a Trump-Moscow-backed channel, the Washington Post reported. The White House denied any knowledge of the meeting. What the editorial said. Don't fall for these diversionary stratagems, said the Washington Post. Ever since evidence started mounting that Trump's team may have been working with the Russians, the president has been doing his best to confuse the public. His ludicrous claim that then-President Barack Obama ordered a wiretap on Trump Tower was an attempt to shift the focus toward leaks and away from his ties to Russia. And now Nunes and other water carriers have taken up that mission. Sorry, but Rice is not credible, said the Wall Street Journal. 2 weeks ago, she was denying any knowledge of surveillance of Trump associates. By asking for the unmasking, she may not have broken the law, but she was clearly motivated by political curiosity. Investigators looking into Trump's Russian connections must also determine whether the Obama administration abused domestic surveillance for its political purposes. What the columnist said, of all the diversionary tactics Trump and his backers have deployed, this ranks among the most desperate, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. Unmasking requests by senior White House officials aren't unusual. Former National Security Agency Director Michael Hayden calls them somewhat routine. As for motive, Rice's alleged request came when investigators were looking into whether Russia had interfered in the election and whether Trump's cronies were trying to undermine U.S. foreign policy by promising to lift Obama's punitive sanctions on Putin. In other words, she was just doing her job. Sorry, but that won't wash, said Andrew McCarthy in NationalReview.com. Rice, who disgraced herself trying to cover for the Obama administration during the Benghazi scandal, asked for the names so they'd spread down the dissemination chain to people who might leak them. Lo and behold, National Security Advisor Michael Flynn later lost his job when details of his wiretapped conversation with a Russian ambassador were leaked. The media can't afford to ignore this story, said Peter Wallison in RealClearPolitics.com. If there's any evidence Obama officials encouraged intelligence agencies to surveil Trump's campaign or transition team, it would be a Watergate-level scandal. The legal unmasking of names during a legitimate investigation is irrelevant, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. What should disturb every American is the mounting evidence that numerous Trump associates, including Flynn, former campaign manager Paul Manafort, and former advisor Carter Page, got money from Russia and had secret meetings with Russians, and then worked for the only candidate pushing a pro-Putin line. Maybe it's all lots and lots of smoke with no fire, but Trump and his loyalists are doing a good impression of panicked people trying to hide something very damaging. In a second main story, Trump shifts on Syria after chemical attack. What happened? President Trump hinted at a change in U.S. policy toward Syria's civil war this week after he accused the regime of Bashar al-Assad of crossing many, many lines by killing dozens of civilians in a chemical weapons attack on a rebel-held town. Survivors said residents of Khan Shikhoun began choking and foaming at the mouth not long after suspected government warplanes had roared overhead and dropped several bombs, which experts believe could have carried the toxic nerve agent sarin. At least 72 civilians died in the attack, Syrian activists said. Videos from the scene showed volunteer medics piling up the bodies of lifeless children. Trump called the attack an affront to humanity and said that, following the atrocity, my attitude towards Syria and Assad has changed very much. Before the gas attack, administration officials had repeatedly said they would not continue President Obama's policy of pushing for Assad's removal. The dictator's fate, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said last week, will be decided by the Syrian people. Trump has not detailed his new policy toward Assad, but did criticize former President Obama for failing to use military force following a similar attack in 2013, a year after declaring that the use of chemical weapons by Assad would cross a red line. That set us back a long way, said Trump, who in 2013 tweeted that Obama should not attack Syria. If you do, very bad things will happen. What the columnist said. It's true that Obama bears responsibility for the horror in Syria, said Jonathan Tobin in NationalReview.com. U.S. inaction allowed Assad to gain the upper hand in the country's six-year-old civil war with the help of his allies, Russia and Iran, and left ISIS looking like the only defender of Syria's Sunni Muslim majority. But this is Trump's mess now, and if he doesn't abandon his dream of closer relations with a Moscow that enables Assad, he'll find himself complicit in one of the great human rights catastrophes of the 21st century. Trump is discovering that every big problem he faces is like Obamacare, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. If there were a good, easy solution, it would have been found already. Should the U.S. focus solely on ISIS in Syria? Assad will keep trying to restore his control over the whole country, which will mean endless massacres. A negotiated power-sharing deal between Assad and the rebels is impossible because there's no trust. The least bad solution is to partition the country, but such a plan would require hundreds of thousands of international peacekeepers. The latest gas attack is a threat to the very heart of foundational international norms, said Thanasis Kambanis in TheAtlantic.com. Yet nobody should be surprised if Trump does nothing but issue empty expressions of outrage. The president has so far practiced an unabashedly transactional foreign policy. Look at his warm words for brutal Egyptian dictator Abdel Fattah el-Sisi during his Washington visit this week. But if the U.S. no longer responds forcefully to acts of barbarity, more tyrants will feel free to slaughter innocents. Today, Syrians suffer. Tomorrow, the world. And our controversy of the week, Pence. When does Christian virtue become sexism? It turns out President Trump and his straight-laced VP Mike Pence have something in common, said Gia Tolentino in NewYorker.com. They share a stated inability to resist women. Trump, of course, is on videotape attesting to his lack of self-control in the presence of beautiful women. Thanks to a profile last week in the Washington Post, however, we've learned that Pence, too, is evidently helpless in the face of female temptation. A devout Christian, the vice president refuses to eat alone with a woman, not his wife, or work late with a female aide, or attend any party where alcohol is being served unless Karen Pence, his spouse of 31 years, is at his side. The Pences are entitled to run their marriage as they see fit, said Heather Schwedel in Slate.com, but their embrace of the Billy Graham rule, named for the evangelical leader who came up with it, does point toward a pretty radically retrograde mindset about women in the workplace. Pence, who calls his wife Mommy, seems to see women primarily as sexual temptations rather than as peers whose ideas might be worth discussing over a sandwich or even, heaven forbid, a glass of wine. Good for Mike Pence, said Charles Cook in NationalReview.com. Despite a loud collective yuck from the liberal media, Pence's personal code makes sense in a town where marriages and careers are routinely destroyed by the explosive mixture of alcohol, long hours of close collegiality, and lust. Far from being a sexist oddball, Pence clearly just thinks that in Karen, he has a great thing going, and he'd rather err on the side of caution to minimize the risk of messing it up. In case you hadn't noticed, men and women are sexually attracted to each other, said Molly Hemingway in TheFederalist.com, and alcohol lowers inhibitions. Infidelity is easily stumbled into, which is why cheating and divorce are so rampant. The Pence's model may not be for everyone, but every married couple that wants to stay that way should develop their own guidelines to protect their marriages. Men can take whatever steps they need to defend their marriages, said Jill Filipovich in Cosmopolitan.com, but it crosses a line when those steps handicap the women you work with. Pence's view of women as sirens and his fear of his own sinful nature put the women who work beneath and around him at a huge, albeit very familiar, disadvantage. Like women across America, his female staffers are excluded from the bonding and mentoring that occur when the boss grabs a beer or dinner or golf game with the boys or an individual male protege. This is one big reason why it's still men who run the show in our society. Pence's no girls allowed dining rule would ensure it's kept that way. This liberal outrage rings hollow, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. If Pence were Muslim and followed the same rule, as devout Muslims indeed might, would liberals be so open in expressing their scorn? What if he were an Orthodox Jew? I suspect the negative reaction to the Pences is less about feminism than about anti-Christian bigotry and liberals' self-loathing of America's traditional culture. Nevertheless, said Olga Kazan in TheAtlantic.com, treating people in workplaces differently based on their gender inevitably hurts women's careers. Besides, Pence should be aware that in 2017, foregoing cocktails with opposite-sex coworkers is no longer a guarantee of fidelity. In the age of sexting, you can always just hit her up on Snapchat. And we're into our good week, bad week section. It was a good week for complicity after President Donald Trump gave his daughter Ivanka an official, though unpaid, White House position as a senior advisor with a security clearance. In a TV interview, Ivanka said that when I disagree with my father, he knows it, and that if being complicit is wanting to be a force for good, then I am complicit. It was a good week for pink diamonds after the most expensive jewel ever sold was auctioned off at Sotheby's. The 59.6-carat pink star diamond was bought for $71.2 million by a Hong Kong jewelry retailer. And it was a good week for a quiet repast after an Italian restaurant in North Carolina saw business double when it decided to stop serving children under age 5. Owner Pasquale Caruso said it ruins his customers' dinners when there's constantly food on the floor, loud electronic devices keeping kids entertained, and small children screaming. But it was a bad week for separate bedrooms after more than 250,000 people signed an online petition demanding that Melania Trump move to the White House from New York City to save taxpayers about $150,000 a day in security costs. This expense yields no positive results for the nation, the petition says, and should be cut. It was a bad week for the gender gap after the Washington Free Beacon reported that equal pay champion Senator Elizabeth Warren on average pays her female staffers $20,000 less than her male staffers. And it was a bad week for Dunkin' Donuts, which agreed to give 3 free buttered muffins or bagels to 1,400 Massachusetts customers to settle a class action lawsuit from a man who was repeatedly served a butter substitute. John Polonic's lawyer said he just really prefers butter. And before we leave this page, a boring but important short, Bannon off NSC. President Trump removed Chief Strategist Stephen Bannon from his seat on the National Security Council this week in a demotion that was reportedly pushed by senior White House aide Jared Kushner. The original decision to elevate Bannon to the council caused controversy in January. Critics said his presence risked politicizing foreign policy. Kushner was increasingly concerned that Bannon's confrontational influence was hurting the president, according to Politico. Trump's decision was seen as a vote of confidence for his new national security advisor, H.R. McMaster, who replaced Michael Flynn. A White House official said Bannon had been placed on the NSC to babysit Flynn and to ensure the council was deoperationalized under Trump. That job is done, the official said. On the briefing page, sugar, the new food villain. Many experts believe that sweetened foods have caused a global health crisis. What's so bad about sugar? Why is sugar in the spotlight? For years, dietitians have warned us to steer clear of fat and cholesterol, the two food evils long believed to be fueling the West's obesity, diabetes, and heart disease epidemics. But a growing number of nutritionists are now pointing the finger at sugar, arguing that our overconsumption of sodas, candy, cookies, and other sweets and processed foods is the real cause of our health crisis. Some even go further, arguing that sugar is an addictive poison that causes a whole host of degenerative ailments, including cancer, even in thin people. Evidence has emerged that shows the sugar industry may have downplayed those risks for profit, turning the modern Western diet into the sweetest in human history. We're in a whole new world of sugar consumption, says Barry Popkin, professor of nutrition at the University of North Carolina. We don't really know what that means for our health. How much sugar do we consume? The average American adult downs 22 teaspoons of the stuff a day. The average child, 32. The World Health Organization recommends just 6 teaspoons a day. Added sugars, those not found naturally in fruits and vegetables like table sugar and high fructose corn syrup, began to proliferate in the Western diet in the mid-20th century, just as scientists were starting to discover links between sugar and heart disease. The sugar industry decided to push back against this research, adopting the aggressive tactics of big tobacco. First, as memos uncovered last September reveal, an industry group paid 3 Harvard nutritionists $6,500, about $50,000 today, to divert the blame. In a 1967 New England Journal of Medicine article, the nutritionist discounted the evidence against sugar and concluded there was no doubt the best way to prevent heart disease was to reduce cholesterol and saturated fat. This is quite what we had in mind, one sugar industry executive said when he saw the article. What did Big Sugar do next? The industry launched an aggressive advertising campaign in the 1970s to convince Americans that sugar actually helps you lose weight by suppressing the appetite. Sugar can be the willpower you need to undereat, one ad asserted. Another recommended eating a cookie before lunch each day. That campaign, combined with work by the Harvard researchers, helped muddy the scientific waters enough to keep dietary sugar guidelines vague. The American Heart Association approved of added sugar as part of a healthy diet, and millions of Americans embraced low-fat, high-sugar diets. Consumption of added sugars soared 30% between 1977 and 2010. It's no coincidence, many nutritionists say, that obesity rates more than doubled over that same period. Why is sugar so bad for us? Scientists have found that refined sugar, which is made up of fructose and glucose carbohydrates, is harder to metabolize than the purely glucose-based carbohydrates found in potatoes and other starches. While glucose is converted into energy by every cell in the body, fructose is mainly metabolized in liver cells. When a person consumes too much fructose, many nutritionists say, the liver becomes overwhelmed and begins converting it into fat, some of which gathers in the liver. An accumulation of fat in the liver can cause insulin resistance, which disrupts the body's ability to maintain stable levels of blood sugar and fat, leading to heart disease and diabetes. Anti-sugar advocate Gary Taubes contends that insulin resistance is a primary driver of obesity and can also give rise to dementia and some cancers. If I'm right about sugar, says Taubes, then it's more harmful ultimately than smoking. Do all nutritionists agree? No. Some, including Fred Brouwens, professor of health food innovation at Maastricht University in the Netherlands, argues that sugar's effect remains poorly investigated and highly controversial. The problem with all nutritional science is that it's difficult to monitor diets over the years-long time span needed to track the causes of degenerative diseases. But there's no doubt that we're lacing modern supermarket food with concentrated sugar in a way that isn't replicated in nature. Kimber Stanhope, a nutritional biologist at University of California, Davis, ordered her staff to eat enough fruit to get 25% of their daily calories from sugar. The quantity she has shown raises the level of artery-clogging triglycerides in the blood. 4 out of 7 of the subjects had to quit. It was more fruit than they could bear to eat, says Stanhope. Yet you can easily get that same amount of sugar by washing down a couple of brownies with a can of Coke. What can be done? Individuals can choose to limit their sugar intake, but that requires avoiding nearly all processed food. Public officials are also trying to nudge society at large toward making healthier choices. In the 2016 election, 3 California cities passed ballot measures imposing taxes on sugary sodas. But conservatives largely oppose these so-called sin taxes, arguing that people should have the freedom to do what they want to their bodies. To cut down on sugar, some people have switched to zero-calorie artificial sweeteners, like the saccharin-based Sweet'n'Low. But little is known about the long-term effects of these chemical substitutes on the body. And because such products can be up to 13,000 times sweeter than sugar, they can trick the body into craving even more calories. Don't be fooled, says metabolism researcher Susan Swithers. We were once led to believe that light and low-tar cigarettes are better choices than regular cigarettes, she says. Neither choice is actually healthy. America's favorite drug. Sugar is everywhere. 80% of supermarket foods contain it, and purportedly savory foods often contain more sugar than sweet treats like ice cream. Whole wheat bread can have a teaspoon of sugar per slice. Heinz tomato ketchup contains 22.8% sugar, twice as much as Coca-Cola. As we swamp our bodies with sugar, we only become more addicted. A 2016 study in Nature Neuroscience suggested that sugar hijacks the brain by triggering its reward system, pushing the body to ask for more and more. Sugar might even be more addictive than recreational drugs, said cardiovascular research scientist James DiNicolantonio. When you look at animal studies comparing sugar to cocaine, even when you get the rats hooked on intravenous cocaine, once you introduce sugar, almost all of them switch to sugar. We'll read a few of the columns now. We'll take the first from the U.S. GOP failure may lead to single payer. Repeal and replace is not quite dead, said Charles Krauthammer. If congressional Republicans want to revive their hopes of replacing Obamacare, they should wait until September when insurers announce their premiums for the coming year and trigger our annual bout of Obamacare sticker shock, a new replacement bill tailored to conservative principles which strips out Obamacare's expensive coverage mandates and includes tort reform and the selling of health insurance across state lines might get through the House. If a second repeal attempt fails, however, Republicans may be paving the way to a government-run single-care system. Thanks to Obamacare, a broad national consensus is developing that health care is indeed a right. This historically new expectation that government should guarantee health coverage to everyone leads inexorably to Medicare for all. It's what President Obama and most Democrats wanted all along. And as their Rube Goldberg wreckage of a health care plan falls apart, the Republican failure to devise an alternative will embolden liberals to propose their own. Don't be too surprised if President Trump, a populist at heart, not a conservative, sees where the wind is blowing and joins the single-payer side. From France, facing the wrath of China. The killing of a Chinese citizen by French police has unleashed rage in China, said Manon Dognin. The Chinese are furious over the killing of Liu Xiaoyou, a 56-year-old father of five who was shot dead by French police in his parents' apartment last week. And they have every right to be. Police say Liu threatened them with a blade, but family members say Liu had scissors in his hand because he was preparing fish for dinner. It's the latter theory that the Chinese believe. French police officers treat Chinese residents like dogs, say posts on Chinese social media sites. They have slaughtered our compatriot. There are calls for a boycott of French goods and demands for an official apology from the French government. Some social media users are even demanding the destruction of the Eiffel Tower. This outpouring of anger has continued for days, and given that China heavily censors the internet, that means Beijing is permitting its people to demonize the French. 4 days after the shooting, a Frenchman was stabbed walking on the streets of Shanghai. It's unclear whether the attack was meant as revenge for Liu, but the French consulate has warned French people in China to be careful. Beijing apparently has no intention of discouraging anti-French sentiment. And from India, putting a bigot in charge is a huge mistake. An outspoken Islamophobe is surely the last person a great Indian political party would choose to run a state containing some 44 million Muslims, said the Deccan Herald. Yet that's exactly what Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party has done. It has appointed Yogi Adityanath, a Hindu nationalist priest with a vile reputation for hate speech, as chief minister of Uttar Pradesh, India's most populous and politically important state. The priest has been named in several ongoing legal cases related to his hostile and objectionable statements against Muslims. He has threatened to force every mosque in the state to erect statues of Hindu deities, and has said that if a Muslim man marries a Hindu girl, we will take 100 Muslim girls. The BJP, which has moderated its own Hindu nationalism in recent years, has previously shrugged off such statements as the ravings of the fringe. But with this appointment, it has legitimized all the outlandish and dangerous views of the bigots that it once insisted were not official policy. The BJP seems to have calculated that putting a rabble-rouser in charge is the way to win votes. Forget about all the talk of inclusive development that Modi has so often mouthed. After this, who could possibly take him at his word? Moving on to our in-depth article, The Last Word. It's titled this week, Tipping the Scales. America's obesity epidemic is fueling a boom in expensive weight loss surgery, extra-wide hospital beds, and supersized grave plots, said journalist Beth Baker. The costs of the crisis are overwhelming our society. In an operating room at Baptist Memphis Hospital, surgeon George Woodman stood over a sedated patient, preparing to insert a 5-inch needle into her huge abdomen, draped with yards of blue surgical cloth. The 30-year-old patient weighed 330 pounds with a body mass index of 46, so heavy she's considered morbidly obese. Woodman made 5 small incisions and slowly inserted the instruments he would use to remove most of her stomach. As he and his team worked, the patient's organs, stomach, spleen, pancreas, liver, pulsing heart, could be seen on a video monitor. 2 gaping hernias became visible, holes torn in the abdominal sac that holds the body's major organs. The belly wall is not designed to hold this much weight, Woodman observed. He pointed out that many tiny blood vessels in the stomach lining. The stomach has a lot of blood supply. That's why it's so good at absorbing terrible foods, he said. By the operation's end, most of the patient's stomach was trimmed away, leaving a much smaller gastric sleeve that would allow her to feel full after eating only small amounts of food. Removing a portion of the stomach also suppresses the hormones that stimulate hunger. The operation, known as laparoscopic sleeve gastrectomy, is now the most common type of weight loss surgery performed in the U.S. Woodman has conducted 6,000 bariatric surgeries and did 3 more that morning. Memphis is the heaviest metropolitan city in the country, with an adult obesity rate of about 36%, approaching the rate of more than 40% that researchers say will reach by 2030 if current trends continue. There's an unlimited number of patients, he said. Memphis may be the heaviest city in the country, but it isn't much of an outlier. From the trimmest state, Colorado, to the most obese, Mississippi, the entire nation has been on a perilous and costly upward track when it comes to extreme weight gain. severe obesity, a BMI of 40 or more, the kind most harmful to individual well-being and expensive to society, is rising at an alarming rate and may affect 11% of U.S. adults by 2030. Dieting and exercise are the prescription for most Americans who want to lose weight, but only a minority succeed. Woodman estimates that just 3% of his morbidly obese patients could lose their excess weight on their own. So for most, bariatric surgery is a last resort option. With luck, this patient will lose about 75% of her excess weight, putting her on track to a healthier future. People say that obesity is self-induced, Woodman said, but it doesn't matter. We have to do something about it. Every 5 days, Woodman holds a seminar for prospective patients. On a recent Saturday, 60 people showed up. Perhaps one-third would ultimately get surgery. For some, Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurance would pay, calculating that the price of the surgery is less than the cost of a lifetime of chronic disease. At Baptist Memphis, the operation cost $14,000. Elsewhere, it is often higher, $25,000 or more. That may seem expensive, but it's a bargain compared with the estimated $200,000 in excess medical costs obese Americans can rack up over their lifetimes. As American waistbands continue to expand, researchers and policymakers are trying to figure out just what the obesity epidemic is going to cost the nation. There are the direct medical costs of treating obesity-related diseases, including type 2 diabetes, heart disease and stroke, high blood pressure, arthritis, and related cancers, among others. And then there are the indirect costs: lost productivity, more illness, extra infrastructure to handle heavier patients and residents. These bills are already coming due in Memphis. Last year, extra health care costs from obesity were $538 million, more than half the budget of the city's public school system, according to Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index. For the state of Tennessee, the annual excess health costs of obesity were $2.29 billion, equivalent to more than 6% of the entire state budget. No matter how many surgeries Woodman conducts, he won't make a dent. Many more Americans are tipping the scales onto the obese range each year. Endocrinologist Jay Cohen, who treats many patients with obesity-caused diabetes, estimates that the average diabetic patient costs the healthcare system triple what a healthy person costs. Add in their lost productivity and the price tag skyrockets. It's politically imperative to reduce the obesity rate, said Cohen. Nationally, it costs literally trillions of dollars to treat these conditions. As costly as the obesity problem is now, it's set to get worse. The baby boom generation is the fattest on record, and they are just reaching the age where health problems begin to mount. Federal and state officials are growing increasingly worried about the steep price the country will pay for its weight problem. In West Virginia, one of the most obese states, Public Health Commissioner Rahul Gupta says the preventable direct medical cost of obesity are $1.4 billion to $1.8 billion a year, with an additional $5 billion in indirect cost, such as lost productivity. Obese patients submit up to 7 times the number of medical claims normal weight patients do, he said. At the state and federal levels, chronic disease burden is among the largest drivers of health care costs, Gupta said. And among chronic diseases, it comes down to the consequences of obesity and tobacco. And then there are the national costs. Zhu Yang, a professor at Emory University who studies the impact of obesity on the medical system, found that obese older males spent $190,657 more on lifetime health care expenses than their normal weight peers, while older obese women spent $223,629 more. A 2016 meta-analysis by University of Washington researchers found that annual medical spending attributed to obesity nationally was nearly $150 billion, more than four times the federal budget for foreign aid and nearly enough to fund the entire U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Other potential costs are harder to quantify, but no less worrisome for patients, taxpayers, and society at large. For example, researchers are discovering that vaccines may not be as effective in those who are obese. Studies have found that obese patients do not respond as well to the HIV vaccine and the flu vaccine, leaving them more vulnerable to infection and to passing those diseases on to others. Over time, it's impossible that a community's herd immunity could suffer, creating the conditions for the return of diseases that were once controlled through immunization, and that could affect us all, according to an analyst at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Even the military is affected as recruiters struggle to find enough soldiers who meet fitness requirements. The percentage of overweight and obese young men doubled over a 50-year period and tripled for young women. According to a study by National Bureau of Economic Research, Navy recruits who were overweight were more likely than their normal weight peers to fail semiannual physical readiness tests. In all, overweight and obese active duty military personnel cost the taxpayer $105 million a year in lost productivity and $1 billion annually in treatments for obesity-related illness, more than treatments for tobacco and alcohol-related illness combined, NBER estimated. Transportation costs, too, are rising, and not only for obese passengers who must purchase two seats to fly. Researchers at the University of Illinois estimated that 1 billion additional gallons of gasoline are consumed in the U.S. each year to ferry overweight and obese car passengers from place to place. One study estimated that U.S. airlines purchased 350 million more gallons of jet fuel because of the number of heavier passengers. Obesity also affects the bottom line of employers. Obesity contributes to absenteeism and presenteeism when people show up but are less productive. Based on current trends, the cost of obesity and lost economic productivity by 2030 will be between $390 billion and $520 billion annually. Obese employees may suffer financially as well. A 2010 study found that white women had 9% lower wages because of obesity, equivalent in absolute value to the wage effect of roughly 1.5 years of education or 3 years of work experience. A study in the Journal of Health Economics found that some employers pay lower wages to obese workers to cover higher insurance costs. Even the cost of dying is higher for obese people. Companies like Goliath Caskets specialize in funeral products for the obese for a price. Everything from wider grave plots to specialized hearses with reinforced chassis and heavy-duty lifting equipment must be used. Crematories are widening furnace doors and chambers to accommodate very large bodies. A supersized funeral costs between $800 and $3,000 more, notes U.S. Funerals Online. The costs are not just related to health care, said Gupta. There's a cost for people who can't reach their full potential in terms of education, employment, mobility, physical activity, and productivity. Driving around Memphis, as in many American cities, it's easy to find cheap, fatty food. Church's Fried Chicken, McDonald's, Crumpy's Hot Wings, barbecue joints abound. Memphis is the hub of diabetes, said endocrinologist Cohen. We fry Twinkies. If Memphis is to avoid an unaffordable fat future, it has to prevent the younger generation from adopting the lifestyle habits of their elders. To that end, Le Bonheur Children's Hospital created a pediatric obesity program that aimed at low-income children. For some kids, it may already be too late. We're seeing adolescents who are more than 500 pounds, said program director Joan Han. At the end of a workday, she and pediatrician-in-chief John McCullers sit in his office to reflect on the obesity epidemic. McCullers was an infectious disease researcher until 5 years ago when he was recruited to Le Bonheur. It was obvious that my research wasn't what they needed, he said. High poverty levels in Memphis had led to a host of urgent problems. Topping the list was obesity. With an infusion of state and hospital funding, he launched the obesity program, which combines research, community outreach, and a healthy lifestyle clinic. Most of the program's $3.5 million annual budget is not covered by patient insurance. What is the goal? Not to be the worst in the country, McCullers says wryly. The clinic has served 650 high-risk kids since opening in October 2014, the majority African-American girls. For these children, a healthy lifestyle can be a new concept. Through surveys, Ham's team found that two-thirds of the families they serve are considered food insecure, despite their obesity. So it's the types of foods they're eating, high in fat, high in sugar, she said. As for exercise, said Han, gym class is held in school hallways, if at all. Despite the immensity of the problem, Han and McCullers try to be hopeful. Nationally, the prevalence of obesity has remained stable for children and teens, and the rate decreased significantly among preschoolers in 2013-14, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We know we can make the obesity rate plateau, said Han. Now we need to make it reverse. Ultimately, they said, it's clear obesity has stopped being a problem that's only one for those affected and is now a national crisis. The country literally cannot afford the impending costs. Shifting investments toward encouraging healthy environments and behaviors rather than paying for expensive, life-threatening chronic disease is the only affordable and humane response. Obesity costs everybody, said Yang. Nobody can escape. Somebody has to pay the bill. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Politico.com. Going to read a technology article this week called Online Privacy, Telecoms Mining Your Search History. What if your telecom company tracked the websites you visit, the apps you use, the TV shows you watch, the stores you shop at, and the restaurants you eat at, and then sold that information to advertisers, asked Jack Marshall in the Wall Street Journal. Thanks to Congress, AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast can now do just that. The House of Representatives voted last week to dismantle strict online privacy rules set up by the Obama administration that would have required Internet service providers to get customers' permission before selling their data to third parties. The legislation, which President Trump signed into law this week, is a huge boon to the major telecoms, which hope to build billion-dollar online ad businesses to rival those of Facebook and Google. If those Silicon Valley giants can turn data into profit, the logic goes, why can't the cable companies, said Clint Finley in Wired.com. It's a decent pitch, but it doesn't hold up under scrutiny. The telecoms have a huge advantage since they provide both wired and wireless networks, seeing nearly everything a user is doing on the web from multiple devices. They're also already squeezing money from us in the form of monthly bills. it's understood and accepted that we give up some personal data and privacy in order to use Facebook and Google for free, but there's no built-in expectation that your providers will double dip by selling your data and collecting advertising fees. To be honest, this brouhaha feels like shouting at the horse to come back long after he's left the barn, said Stephen Carter in Bloomberg.com. Why is it disturbing that Verizon and AT&T suddenly want to act like Google and Facebook? We traded away our online privacy long ago. For now, you probably won't notice any difference, said Brian Chin in the New York Times. The rules that Congress overturned were so new that they hadn't even taken effect yet. But while ISPs have always been able to monitor what websites you visit and then share some of that data with third parties, they are now likely to become much more aggressive with data collection and retention. There's only so much you can do these days to protect your digital data, short of going off the grid, said Timothy Lee in Vox.com. One option is to use a virtual private network, which hides your browsing information from your internet provider. But those can be pricey and hard to set up. And most internet users can't be bothered with such a complicated workaround. The advantage of the just overturned rules was that consumers would get privacy by default. Now, the burden is on us. And we will finish out the hour on the Talking Points page. We've got one here titled Kushner, the White House's princeling. In a White House where President Donald Trump commands reverence, only one man gets to call him Donald, said Josh Dawsey in Politico.com. That's Jared Kushner, Trump's 36-year-old son-in-law who has both the president's ear and his implicit trust. Trump has handed Kushner a vast portfolio that includes forging a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians, negotiating with China and Mexico, and reinventing government according to business principles. This week, Kushner even traveled to Iraq to evaluate the war on ISIS. Resentful White House sources complain that Kushner, who has spent his life running his inherited real estate company, does essentially what he wants, but is utterly out of his depth. The princeling, as the Chinese now view Kushner, has only one qualification for his vast new powers, said Jeet here in NewRepublic.com. He is married to Trump's beloved daughter, Ivanka. Trump's decision to rely on Kushner should not be surprising, said Michael D'Antonio in CNN.com. While running his private real estate company, Trump has long depended on the extreme loyalty of the family. Kushner, the son of a billionaire, also plays into Trump's overriding belief that wealth is the ultimate proof of competence and intelligence. Actually, Kushner is well-suited to help Trump bring business efficiencies to our bloated bureaucratic government, said Cheryl Chumley in the Washington Times. Who better to do that than a former real estate and media executive with a string of financial accomplishments? I worked for Jared Kushner, said Elizabeth Spears in the Washington Post. And from what I saw of his skills in publishing and real estate, the nation is in trouble. In 2011, Kushner hired me as editor-in-chief of the New York Observer, a newspaper he bought at the tender age of 25. During my tenure, Kushner reversed his pledge to me to expand the staff and pursue growth, and embarked on a nihilistic cost-cutting spree that badly damaged the once-respected newspaper and website. He later shut down the print edition and put the website up for sale. In real estate, Kushner almost destroyed the family's fortune by going deeply into debt to acquire 666 Fifth Avenue for a Manhattan record price of $1.8 billion. I worry that Kushner's time in government is yet another vanity project, one where his expertise isn't just low, but non-existent. Let's see. We'll do some shorter notes now. Pedestrian deaths soared by 25% between 2010 and 2015, according to a new report by the Governor's Highway Safety Association. More than 28,000 pedestrians were killed by cars nationally during that period. The distracting use of smartphones by both pedestrians and drivers is believed to be a major factor in the increase. Drone purchases are booming, with more than 770,000 drone registrations in the past 15 months. The number of small hobbyist drones in the country is expected to triple to about 3.55 million by 2021. Almost one in four married couples sleep in separate bedrooms, according to a new survey from the National Sleep Foundation. Many cited snoring, different sleep schedules, or restless leg syndrome as the reason. In 86% of U.S. counties that voted for Donald Trump, the total annual income of the entire population is less than the collective $2.3 billion net worth of 27 of President Trump's closest aides. His cabinet is the wealthiest in U.S. history. And on the poll watch, 20% of people ages 18 to 34 identify as LGBTQ, a big increase from Generation X, 12%, and the baby boomer generation of 7%. And we'll finish out with a quote from poet Anatole France. He says, "Without lies, humanity would perish of despair and boredom." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.